This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Sean Davis. He's the author of a new book called The Wax Bullet War. It's a memoir of his life experience, starting prior to going, but mostly covering the period during and after he was in the war in Iraq. So, Sean, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
So, you know, we won't probably want to repeat every bit of your story, but, you know, what's interesting to me is that you were in the, first you were in the Army.
Right.
So going back, you know, to your early times, you know, you kind of joined up and served a tour, and then you were out of the Army by the time, kind of trying to figure out what to do with your life, it sounds like.
Right.
Around the time then when 9/11 occurred, September 11th, 2001, you were, like a lot of people, I think, stimulated to rejoin, but you went ahead and joined the Oregon National Guard. And I suspect at that point you didn't have any idea of what that might mean for you.
No, I mean, I thought that I'd be guarding the airport, or we have a Umatilla chemical ground. I think they've since burnt all the chemicals, but I thought we might be out there guarding that, you know. And then a year and a half, I was in Iraq. You know, I enjoyed my service, and I actually did two tours when I joined at the regular Army. You know, I joined in 1993. Then I got out in 99, went to Hawaii, Schofield Barracks, Hawaii, out to Fort Drum, New York, and then over to Germany. But I was fine to get out, you know. I left and went back home to Portland and signed up for art school. And then I was working a job, going to school, and then 9/11 happened, and I joined up the next day. And you know, I used to like to say that I joined because I don't know, out of patriotism or something, but, you know, looking and really looking at that part of my life, honestly, that might have been part of it, but I just wanted to do something else. I needed, some more adventure in my life, you know. I missed the military, as so many of us do, but I didn't miss it enough to join back up in the regular Army, you know, so I joined the Oregon National Guard.
Right.
Well, it actually turned out to be like the regular Army again, you know.
Right, I think that's the real surprise for a lot of people. And of course, you know, it's not like you can't be activated. You know, of course, when you're in the National Guard, you're ready to serve at a moment's notice and do whatever needs to be done. But I think it was probably a really, and not just for you, but for all of your comrades.
Shock.
You know, yeah, I mean, you weren't expecting to be essentially treated like regular military at that point.
Yeah, completely. I had no idea that that was an option, honestly. I think that sentiment was shared by a lot of people. I mean, not to that extent. I mean, National Guard units from all over the country were sent. You know, I was over there with Oklahoma's National Guard, Arkansas's National Guard, Louisiana's National Guard. It was, we relieved a lot of the regular Army guys, but it was crazy.
Well, and was it, I guess, strategically, it was because they'd made such, I mean, and, you know, we're not going to argue whether the war was good or bad. I mean, I have my own opinion about it, but just, it was what it was at that point. They had overcommitted, essentially, resources that the military didn't have, so they had to call up National Guard units because there just weren't enough regular Army guys, you know, available.
Oh, people and equipment, you know. A lot of us had to buy our own radios from, like, sporting goods stores.
Right, and that, you reminded me so much. I mean, I had forgotten all about that when you're first landed, your Humvees were really ill-equipped. You had, you know, stuff that wasn't really all, it wasn't that great to begin with, but it wasn't armored, and you weren't prepared for the, you know, the kind of warfare that was being waged against you, which was the IEDs. You know, the Humvees were, they just weren't built for that. And so what you described a lot was the sort of, you know, kind of standard military activity. You know, soldiers figure out ways of doing things on their own. And so you guys were,
We were ripping off plates of armor from old tanks.
Old Iraqi tanks, it was an Iraqi tank graveyard. But a lot of the stuff that you talked about, I thought, you know, there was very poignant in a way, was that you were talking about the guys you were with, you know, through your training, who they were as human beings. It's, you know, because you're not regular army, it's a little bit different. And even though, you know, everybody's a human being, there was a sort of, you made it very personal with all the guys you went with. And of course that leads to what happens later on. And, you know, I don't want to give away everything that happened, but, you know, your story is somewhat known because of what happened to you later. You know, and you talked a lot about this one particular guy who became your friend. I mean, you're sort of the artistic guy in the group. You know, you're the artist, and I don't know whether that makes you the sensitive guy, you know, in a group of men. But you know, in a lot of ways, it probably does. But you had this friend.
Oh yeah.
You had your friend Simon, who was also a sensitive guy. It sounds like you know. Somebody that you really related to.
Yeah, he would, he just didn't buy into the whole, you join the military and right away you're indoctrinated and you have a rank structure and you have to go by it. And as National Guard guy, I mean, we still go through a lot of the same training, but he just didn't buy into it. He'd say, "Hey, Sean, what's up?" Like, "You can't call me Sean in front of the other guys, you know." But when we're in his trailer drinking coffee together, that's fine. You know? But it didn't matter. He just always did, even though I'd make him do push-ups or something.
I forgot to mention, you were, because you had the experience of being regular Army, when you got into the National Guard, you were made a sergeant.
Right.
You know, you had experience, you had leadership responsibilities. So you were, you know, so when you were talking to Simon, he's an enlisted guy. He's supposed to be in your, you know, you're supposed to maintain those relationships of rank.
But it's like you were talking about, we're all human, you know, and he was one of the most human people I've ever met. He was an amazing person. Great. And we became really good friends, you know. And not to say the other guys weren't. I mean, they're great. But I did, when I wrote about it, I wanted people to know that we're all human. Because, of course we are. But soldiers come back. A lot of people think, okay, they're heroes. You know, these are all everybody's a hero, no matter what they did. Like, and I love the fact, and I respect everybody who wore a uniform in all services. But if you think everybody, all the soldiers are heroes, or all the servicemen are heroes, you lose the fact that we're just humans. And when we do, we make mistakes, you know. And when we do acts of courage, like one of my guys, when I got hit, you know, he grabs his aid bag and he runs towards us under direct fire of machine guns to try to help us. Then he gets another explosion goes off and he gets wounded as well. I mean, yeah, it's easy to say, oh, that's just a soldier, that's what a soldier's going to do. But if you think of him as a person, as a human, like, you know, and you make it relatable to your life, would you do that? You know, that's an amazing, amazing thing. It should really, you know, move someone. You know, so that's why I wanted this. This isn't a book about war. I don't see it as a war book. I see it as a book about people that went to war. But it's... there's too many books out there, and I'm not, you know, criticizing anybody's book, but the books out there that are war stories, you know, and these are real people that are going through these events. That's what I wanted to show, so everybody can relate to it, and that the family members of veterans can see what their, you know, their son, or their husband, or even their daughter, or even their father or mother, what they go through when they're in the military. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, and there's a lot of stuff that goes on when they come back as well.
Well, yeah, I do think you very much humanized the story. I mean, you treated everyone with respect. In, you know, the people, even people that you might not have felt so positively inclined to, you know, you gave everyone their humanity, their due as humans. You know, I was thinking as you were talking that maybe what we need to think is that everyone who goes to war in service of their country is heroic, not necessarily hero. They're heroic for doing that, but then you think of them as human beings who have this characteristic of being heroic, but that doesn't, it's not the same as being a literal hero. And of course, some are heroes, and I think there are heroes made in many different ways. It's not just the person who saves another, although that definitely is a heroic, and that person is a heroic act, and that is a heroic a hero. But there are many other ways of being a hero, and in some ways, you know, you get to be a hero for, in my view anyway, for telling the truth and for being so honest about yourself. And I'm, you know, not trying to, you know, just give you strokes, but you told a lot of stories here about yourself. You revealed a lot about yourself that I think takes a lot of courage. That
and honestly, it is. It's terrible. I think it's scary. It's still scary to me because, you know, people are reading the book and they see parts where I was just a wreck, you know, the most vulnerable parts of me. And I'm not proud of that time that I had when I came back and I was trying to fit back into society. And I drank way too much. And it was a very self-destructive time in my life. And I'm not writing about it because I was proud of it. I'm writing about it to show, you know, just what people go through. And I hope that other people can either say, other veterans can say, wow, somebody else is going through the same thing that I'm going through right now, or a veteran's family member is saying, like, wow, this is what my son is going through, or this is what my husband is going through, that type of thing.
Well, both on a personal level and on a kind of societal level, I think it's really important to know how difficult it is after you go through the kinds of experiences that soldiers go through. And I think it's, you know, that to me was the value of what you wrote about in the post. Well, actually, it wasn't even in the full-on return, because there was a period when you were sent home after being wounded, but you were still in service. And you were pretty much of a wreck. Now, you were, as a National Guards member at that point, you didn't have to be on duty every 24 hours a day. But when they needed you, you were supposed to be there. And you were so screwed up from, people were trying to help you. But, you know, it's like anything else, when you can only be helped when the right moment comes along that you can recognize what's going on for yourself and begin your own healing process. You know, it just, people can't just treat emotional, psychological wounds as if they were physical wounds that you can just, you know, you can sew somebody up, you can give them drugs, you can make them feel better physically, but psychologically and emotionally, it doesn't work that way. It's not just, it's not mechanical. It's too much on the person to be present enough to begin to heal, and that's really hard.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and I work with guys that are coming back or had been back for a long time right now, and I see that all the stages that they go through, the stages that I went through. And I don't want to make this book like, oh, hey, poor me, this is what happened to me because the war messed me up at all. I don't want people to think that's what it is, you know. I want to show people that you can live through it and be a benefit to society. I mean, it's difficult. And when, you know, like, I hate the term PTSD. I hate it because PTSD is like this heartless acronym that they throw everything into. You have anger issues, you get PTSD. You can't sleep at night, PTSD, you know. You feel detached to society, PTSD. You have irritable bowel syndrome, you have PTSD. And the reality is like, we're doing a disservice to our best and brightest by just lumping all of that stuff into one just, you know, term that just, it's been said so much that it's lost all its meaning.
Yep. Well, you know, it's the same. It is exactly the same as ADD or ADHD. It's the same way that we kind of what it it's a what people are trying to do is put it in a box so they can put it away. You know, you can sort of understand it, and then okay, now he has PTSD. Well, that explains everything. Doesn't do anything, but it allows people to, you know, the categorization allows people to have comfort. You know, like
I completely but not only that, but it allows the veterans that come back to use it as an excuse to not go through that difficult transition back into society. I have PTSD. Of course I have anger issues or memory problems. I just have PTSD. And I see it sometimes, just all of us. It's documented since the beginning of time. Every time somebody goes and fights in combat and they come back into, you know, the society that they fought for, they're going to have issues. You know, the American Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. And I love that. I love that. You know, I know they named it like it was like a tennis elbow or black lung, but that shows the humanity in it, you know, it is. Like I said, I go and I help out veterans now around the area. I live in Portland, and just 2 weeks ago, I went to go meet somebody I hadn't met except for online. A Marine flew helicopters in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and we're talking for a half an hour and telling combat stories, and all of a sudden, we're just both big guys, but we're crying our eyes out at the bar, you know, and the bartender comes up and sees us and just kind of backs away, you know, but and that's the soldier's heart that I'm talking about, you know. I never met this guy before. Different wars, different deployments, but we can relate to, you know, things that we've done, and we can share emotionally, and that helps.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's true. I think you're right. It's any deployment, any war, any action that involves the kinds of thing, you know, it's life and death, and you know, it creates that. I mean, of course, it does create a bond, but it also has these unforeseen consequences, and they're not always visible. I mean, even people who seem okay are not always okay. Right. You know, there are. You know, I think that it's, and I think as you started talking about at the very beginning, the best war books are, there are the ones that are about the people so that we understand who the people were, what they went through, what their lives were like before, during, and after. And I read a book by a guy. In fact, I interviewed this writer about another book he did. It's and this one too, but a writer named Carl Marlantes. I don't know whether you've ever run across
him. Oh yeah, Matterhorn, yeah. And I was like to go to combat. I love that. I even saw him speak here a couple months ago in Portland.
Yeah, I think the later book is Why We Go to War, and I think he talks a lot about that. You know, the same sort of things that you're talking about in that book. It's you know, you've. It's so often that we don't think about war in those human terms. You know, it becomes, you know, kind of made into, like, into understandable pieces of information rather than human. And I think the reason that we do that is because we know, whether we've experienced it directly or not, we know that war is so damaging. You know,
we distance ourselves from it. Society distances itself from it. You know, you come back from war. I come back and I'm hurt, you know. Really, it took me a lot of time even to walk again, and I finally get back home, and it's like, you know, we're not at war at all. And there's a big gap between when you get back and when the VA helps you. And I love the VA, and they did a lot of stuff for me, but there's about a year gap where I was on my own, and, you know, 6 months. You know, 6 months ago, I am planning and executing combat missions, and then now today I have to get a job. I had a job as a waiter on a floating restaurant, and I'm just so angry because now I'm not saying anything bad about being a waiter, but that transition for me was so shocking. It's like, I was important. I was somebody. I had a life and death in my hands, and now I'm, you know, nobody, and I can't, you know, I have to worry about trivial things like relationships and trying to pay the rent and, you know, whatever else, car payments. And I just, you're at a loss. You don't know what to do, you know?
I know. I think that's very poignant. And, Well, of course, the criticism that we can make of our own society is that when we send people off to war, the biggest problem is that we don't invest in their return. And so we, in terms of economics, I think of it as, it's an external cost, it's something that is not recognized by the system, so it's externalized. And we've done that. It's expensive to go to war. It's expensive in so many ways, but the true costs are not even calculated. And one of the costs that is not is the lack of investment in the soldiers returning. You've done your service. You do get a lot of things. You get VA.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff that's done. I don't want to say nothing. It's not like there's nothing done, but there's still more that is.
But us as a society has to take responsibility for it, I think. And really, I don't know. I couldn't ask for any more. VA paid for my schooling, I still have some problems from getting blown up, and they help me with my health care, and it's good stuff, But I don't want to complain, but if there would be less problems with veterans to come back. We're losing them. 22 suicides a day. We lose more people at home here than we are fighting, And it's because these soldiers who are taken from society and put far from home and asked to do things that our society would deem, that you'd go to jail for. You're kicking in people's doors and searching their houses and sometimes having to shoot them or, stuff like that. And then you put back into the society that asked you to do it like nothing happened. And, you're so isolated from it because you don't belong there anymore. In your head, you don't think that you belong there anymore. A lot of these guys don't have, they feel like they don't have purpose anymore because there's no mission and they don't know what to do with themselves. They lost their identity, they have no purpose, and then they're just kind of flailing. And that's what happened to me. And art was my purpose. Art saved my life. Painting and writing, and it gave me back my purpose. And then the VA happened to come a little after that and help me go to school. And boom, I had my master's degree in 5 years, all I needed was a direction to go into, and a lot of these guys are just spinning, and it's tough. It's really tough.
Well, and, I guess to say, you're an unusual person, in a lot of ways. You're an artist, you're a writer. I even think about some of the things you did and said about what happened to you in Iraq. I mean, there are things that, you show yourself as being an aware person. So here's a question that kind of necessarily leads from what you just said. If you could come up with a system or a method of addressing the problem that you just described, these are people who had responsibilities, who were important, and who had a mission when they were in the service and in the war. When they come home and they don't have that anymore, what could we do to give them?
I started a nonprofit called Iraq or Something Productions. And I get veterans into the arts. I have them do stage plays, write the plays or act in them or direct them. I get them. I've got a bunch of them on Grimm, the TV show that's been filmed out here in Portland. Right now, I have veterans at my house as we're talking, being interviewed by a European film crew for a movie called Human, the movie. I have painting. Art therapy, painting lessons. I am helping produce an opera called The Canticle of the Black Madonna about a PTSD veteran returning from Afghanistan and having issues. I'm going to have veterans on stage. It's a $250,000 opera at our best venue in Oregon, the Newmark Theater. I'm going to have veterans on stage as supernumeraries, have veterans helping out backstage, and it's working. I have veterans just come up to me and say, Sean, I wasn't doing this. I would just be drunk on my couch right now. Not veterans. It started out veterans just for my deployment, but it ends up being people that I've never met before coming up to me at like a reading because I published some anthologies of writer stories under a rock or something. And, they come up with tears in their eyes and they hug me. I'm like, thank you for this. And they might not even have written a story in the anthology, but it was an excuse for them to get out of their house. Because I said that we all tend to isolate. And when there's a veteran event and they get out there and they around their brothers, it just so helps them out so much. You know? And so we could do something like that. And these companies are popping up. I see them all over the place. You know, the telling with soldier stories that went all the way across America, and the president watched it. There's some other things. I saw another veteran opera today, actually. I read about in the paper about Fallujah. It was called Fallujah. And so get veterans into the arts. And I know it's just such a small population of us. A percentage of the population is our veterans, and maybe it might be not all of us want to be into the arts, but there are, you know, give them a new purpose through small companies. Get them out hiking. One of my buddies just he gets back. He hikes, or give them jobs, because we are the best and the brightest. We will accomplish missions, you know. And that's what I say when I talk to people. Hire us. I mean, honestly, hire us. Or if you know somebody that's going through a lot of issues, ask them to do something for you. If it's to help you move or to help you paint your house. Because they need a mission. When we come back, we need a mission. That's what you can do to help out.
Oh, I think that's great. You actually, I'm amazed. I didn't have any idea. That wasn't a leading question even. I didn't know that you had, you actually had done all of this. It's fantastic. And I think...
I'm doing it.
I think it makes sense. Maybe somebody listening to this will have the idea that, you know, that could be expanded, you know, and maybe there's somebody out there with the ability to expand on the idea of...
Yeah, start your own. You know, I'm a little skeptical of the bigger vet companies. You know, I see how much money they take in, and I see how much money they give out, because all that stuff's public record, and it's small is the way to go. Community size, you know. When it gets big and turns into bureaucracy, people get lost. At least that's my opinion, you know.
Well, yeah, I believe in decentralization and small structures. But I think if you can replicate, you know, if somebody can replicate that, you know, seeing one and say, I could do that myself, or, you know, we could encourage people to do that all around the country, that would be fantastic.
So, the LLC or the nonprofit status, and all together we had to raise, I think, about $3,000 or $4,000. We did that through different things. You know, I put a lot of my own money into it. But right now, people are coming to us about projects. Say, hey, can you help us be the veteran service coordinator on this, or bring veterans to this? Once you get it up and running in your own community, people will come to you, you know, and I really hope that, you know, if somebody listens to this, like, thinking about whether or not they should do it, they do it, you know, because it's worthwhile.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Just to see people are like, you're helping me out so much, you know, I mean, it's really, really great thing.
Well, so do you have, does your organization, what's the name of your organization again?
A Rock or Something Productions. When you eat an MRE, I know you know Meals Ready to Eat,
yeah.
You know, the rations that they give us, the MRE heater says, you know, you pour water in it, you put your main meal, and says, lean against a rock or something. So it's kind of an inside joke for soldiers and servicemen. But it also means, like, you can lean against it, because, you know, we're here. We're here for you. So, cool.
No, that's really good. Well, I have to ask you one question, and that is about the title of the book. I think it's really good for people who are hearing this to know what the wax bullet reference is about, because that's one of your, I would say, you know, kind of ironically told stories. Maybe you could tell that.
Yeah, it is. Actually, the publisher came up with the name. I was going to call it something simple, like The Chronicles of an Artist Soldier. I don't know. I like the painting daisies in Valhalla, but the wax bullet war, I love it. You know, they said, like, we have to do this. And that one scene's kind of become a whole, like, a metaphor for it all, you know. But when we first get to Kuwait, you know, we're sent to Kuwait, and Kuwait, that's a crazy part, too. You can't see anything. It's flat in every direction for as far as you can see. At that point, you think the entire world is flat. And then you turn around, and they have this army base where they have Burger King and Subway and Starbucks. You know, it's like I compare it to colonizing Mars. Everything is running off of diesel generators and water. And it must take millions and millions of dollars to get this thing going. Anyway, so we're there first for a month so we can climatize, you know, get used to the heat. And
before we go up to Iraq, they think it's a great idea that we make our weapons as accurate as possible. And so they take us out to a firing range run by some, you know, former Navy SEALs. And they give us, they replace our top receivers, our weapons, you know, kind of split in half. You have the lower part and the top half. And they give us something else that is able to fire wax bullets. And I have no idea why they would come up with it. You know, maybe they thought the wax bullets would be more cost effective, but in reality it costs more than the 5.56 ammo did. And this is 120 degree heat, you know. They're giving us wax bullets. It's ridiculous, like pop, pop, and then it jams. And it doesn't help us make our weapons more accurate at all. In fact, it does the opposite. And it's just, why don't, that's the big thing. I asked my lieutenant, like, why don't they give us real bullets? And he turns like, well, we're only going to war. That's what we do, you know. We might shoot ourselves or something. We just kind of all laugh about it. And that was the scene.
Well, it's a great scene.
It's stuff like that happens all the time. You're like, why?
It's classic Army, you know, classic yeah. Army stories. It's just like you would read in Catch 22. You know, that you, okay, of course, it's 120 degrees. Let's give them wax bullets. Perfect, you know. some guy in you know, in D.C. or Virginia.
Somebody got a promotion, yeah. I'm not sure of it for that idea.
I know, that was great. And that was a very symbolic, you know, kind of element to the story, which I thought was great. Well, you know, the book is, I think, is really terrific. I know there's much more we could have talked about, and there's a lot to your story that I think is really powerful. I hope we've given people a, you know, at least a taste of what it's about and a sense of the book, because I really hope people will read it. I want to thank you for being on the program, Sean. This has been...
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. This is... Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. We've been talking to Sean Davis, and the book is called The Wax Bullet War.